My name is Ray Choate. I'm the University Librarian here at the University of Adelaide. I normally now say it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to the Barr Smith Library, but instead I welcome you to the Flinchy Theatre. As proper as this event is, we probably should have tried to hire the Albert Hall next time. The first thing I have to do is, if you have one of these devices, which in my case is a mobile phone disguised as a book, please turn it off. It's nothing more disconcerting to a speaker than to have mobile phones go off. So while you're turning that off, I would like to say two things. I have apologies from the president of the Friends of the Libraries, Professor Chris Burrell, who cannot be here this evening. He sends his apologies. And I also would like, even though he's not here this evening, to offer our congratulations and share them with you to Professor Oliver Mayo, previous president of the Friends of the University Libraries, for having won a Distinguished Alumni Award from the University of Adelaide. And whenever he comes again, we will share that with him. Now that we're all settled in, I would like to introduce one of our committee, Felicity Morgan, who will continue the evening. Felicity.
Good evening, everyone. It's fabulous to see such a large crowd. Hannah Kent was the inaugural winner of the Writing Australia Unpublished Manuscript Award in 2011 for her manuscript entitled Burial Rites. And you may be interested to know that Dr. Patrick Allington of Adelaide University's creative writing department then was a member of the four-person panel who selected it. I first heard of Hannah back in the middle of last year when I was reading a newspaper article reporting that her manuscript had been the subject of an intense international bidding war between publishers. As soon as I read this, I knew that she was someone we would like to have as a speaker for the Friends of the Library, and particularly when I learned also that Hannah is an Adelaide girl. Hannah's friend, mentor and supervisor of her PhD, Ruth Starkey, who unfortunately can't be here tonight, from Flinders University, put me in touch with Hannah. And Hannah, despite all the buzz and excitement surrounding her at the time, very graciously agreed right then and there that we would have a date with her after publication sometime in 2013. In the meantime, since the publication of Burial Rites earlier this year, Hannah's publishers, Picador, have had her whizzing around the world on book tours, book signings, and speaking engagements. But, true to their promise and to hers, I'm thrilled to say we have Hannah with us tonight. Burial Rites is a hauntingly beautiful novel set in 1829 in a remote, austere, and little-known country, Iceland. For those of you who'd like to know a little bit more about Iceland, you can read what Hannah has written in an author's guide for Fodor's The Travel Guide series. In this guide, Hannah quotes W.H. Auden, "Few people take an interest in Iceland, but in those few, the interest is passionate." To this, Hannah writes, "Truer words were never spoken." Now let's get inside Iceland and hear the voice of the sad and ill-fated heroine, Agnes Magnusdóttir, from the author herself. Please give Hannah Kent a very warm welcome.
I'm so thrilled to be here tonight. Thank you all for coming. I can't believe there's so many of you. I've actually been away for the past 2 months on a tour, as Felicity was saying, in the UK and in the US, and I've actually not even been home for a week. And to come home to my hometown, to all of you, is probably the best welcome back that I could ever could have hoped for. So thank you so much. Also, if I start slurring my words or swaying, I promise you I'm not drunk. I'm just incredibly jet-lagged and fatigued. Tonight I thought I'd talk a little bit about where the idea for my debut novel, Burial Rites, came from. Since it was published in May, many people have asked me why I decided to write my first novel about a murderess in 19th century Iceland, of all places. And really, to explain myself, I have to take you back about 10 years ago, when I was 17 years old and fresh out of high school. Like a lot of teenagers finishing school, I was very, very nervous at the prospect of selecting an appropriate university course and a career path. I had always known I wanted to be a writer, but I also understood that I should probably go and get a degree in something that would afford me some kind of financial stability. The problem was, back then, I had no idea what this something else should be. So, as a deferral tactic for this big life decision I thought I had to make back then, I'd ended up applying for a 12-month Rotary exchange program. Now, I'm sure there's quite a few people here tonight. In fact, I know there's some Rotarians here who are familiar with how the programs work. But for those of you who haven't heard much about it, basically, you put in an application to be sent to another country for 12 months where you'll attend school and live with various host families. And in your application, you are asked to nominate three countries that you would like to be considered for. But the final decision basically lies with the selection committee. And I remember putting in my application and deciding what those three countries should be. And I ended up putting down Iceland, Switzerland, and Sweden. And the reason I put those three countries down was simply because I'd never seen snow before, Adelaide. And I thought I'd be in with a pretty good chance if I was sent to any of those three. Anyway, I remember going through the first round of interviews and going to there was a sort of a several day long process. And I finally got round to the final set of interviews, and I was seated in front of three Rotarians. And by this stage of the program, of the application process, they were asking you all the sort of difficult questions, How will you deal with the inevitable homesickness that you might feel? Or what do you do if your host brother cracks onto you? That sort of thing. And that was a question, probably not phrased quite like that. And then one of them turned to me and said, "Hannah, how would you react if you were sent somewhere where it was dark 24 hours a day in winter?" And I know I surprised them with my reaction because I said, "That sounds fascinating. I would absolutely love to experience a winter like that." And I remember them looking at one another and sort of raising their eyebrows, and one of them putting a big fat cross next to my name on the paper in front of him, which is probably why I was the only applicant to be sent to Iceland. So anyway, this is how I ended up in early 2003 in a very small town called Sauðárkrókur, which is a fishing village in the north of Iceland. This is a very small, fairly isolated town, and it lies snug in the side of a fjord and comprises not much more than a clutch of little colourful buildings which face out onto an iron grey sea. The mountains loom behind it and also across the other side of the fjord, where there's a harbour in between as well. When I arrived in January, the days were gripped by darkness for probably up to about 20 hours at a time, and the sunlight, if you could ever really call it that, was nothing more than this brief blue twilight, as you can see in the photo, that would sort of slowly creep in at about 11 o'clock in the morning and entirely vanish again and abandon you by about 3 in the afternoon. There were no trees whatsoever. You can see from the shrubbery that that's about as sort of forest-like it gets in Iceland. In fact, there's an Icelandic joke which is, what do you do if you get lost in an Icelandic forest? And the answer is stand up. So there you go. You would basically, if you walked through the edge of this road, you would get to the fishing factory in the harbour, and if you looked out, you could see the north sky meet the North Atlantic Ocean in what seemed to me back then as nothing more than a suggestion of oblivion. It felt like the absolute edge of the world. I mean, this is a place where if you looked out the window at 11 o'clock at night, everything you could see was green because of the intensity of the northern lights that were all across the sky. Sometimes they were so thick you couldn't see the stars. It's absolutely uncanny. Now, my first host family were really, really generous to take me in and were only ever civil to me, but as the first few months of my exchange crept past, I became intensely lonely. The community of Sauðárkrókur, as you might imagine of any small community, was very small, very tightly knit, and as the exchange student in town, I was also undoubtedly the outsider. Everyone knew who I was, even before I'd even met them. Yet no one really spoke to me in the first couple of months. I have a good example of this, of just how strange this was. I had to attend high school as part of this exchange program. And early on in this kind of light, I was walking to school in the snow. And I could hear a car pull up behind me. And, you know, expecting it to drive past, I sort of didn't think anything of it. And then I noticed that it wasn't passing me. So I slowed down and I looked at it, and the car slowed down. And I thought, well, you know, in Adelaide, if a big black SUV pulls up next to you and you're in the dark and it's kind of following you, you speed up. So that's what I did. I started speeding up. No street lights anywhere. Started speeding up. I could hear the car rev. It came and pulled up next to me. I stopped completely. The car stopped. I turned around and faced it. And I could hear all the windows and then see them being rolled down. And all of a sudden, all the faces of the car's occupants pressed and looked outside the window, had a good look at me, started talking amongst themselves. I had not a clue what they were saying, but I could hear my name and I could hear the word Australia. And then after they'd sort of seen enough, nodded and kind of kept on driving. And I realised that they had just heard about this exchange student in town and just wanted to get a good look at her. But it was a very, very strange position to be in. And in fact, it was probably the first time in my life that I had felt this socially isolated, yet this conspicuous. And these feelings of alienation that I was experiencing were certainly compounded by this constant darkness and the constant confinement indoors as well because of the inclement weather. Basically, at the local school, I had to attend all sorts of classes where I understood absolutely nothing. I don't know if anyone has ever had to learn French in Icelandic, but it does raise additional challenges. And so... basically feeling impossibly stupid and impossibly incomprehending, I found and sought shelter in the library, in the high school library, and I found my consolation in books and in writing. Now, it was during these first difficult months of my exchange that I was driven through a place in the north called Vatsdalshola. I was actually returning northwards after a visit in the south with my host family. And we were sort of driving along. You can see this is the National Highway. It's called Road or Highway 1, and it goes the whole way around the country. And we were heading up, you know, across this landscape of very sort of broad, sweeping, pastoral valleys interrupted by mountain ranges, when suddenly we came to this area where, as you can see, there are hundreds and hundreds of very small hills sort of clustered very closely next to one another. And none of them are actually any higher than probably where that blackboard is there. And I was really, really struck by this landscape. As you can see, it looks completely bizarre. And I wondered whether it was man-made. In fact, I thought it might be something along the lines of Viking burial mounds, having seen a documentary or two. And I asked my host parents if this is what they were. And they said, no. These hills were actually caused by an avalanche several hundred years ago. But it is interesting that you mention this place, because they pointed to three small hills that were nestled closely together, and they said that over 150 years ago, a woman called Agnes Magnusdottir had been beheaded there. She was the last person to be executed in Iceland. Now, I was immediately curious, as I think probably anyone would be on hearing just a snippet of a story like this, and I asked my host parents what this woman, Agnes, had done and what had happened, and I discovered that Agnes was a 34-year-old servant woman who had been beheaded on the 12th of January in 1830 for her role in the 1828 murders of two men. And the crime, as it has more or less been recorded, and as I eventually sort of discovered it during the course of my exchange, goes along these lines. In the early hours of the 14th of March in 1828, Agnes Magnusdottir woke up the people living at a farm called Stapakoti on a very remote northern peninsula in Iceland, telling them that Illugastadir, which was the next farm over where she lived and worked, was burning down. She told them that Illugastadir, this croft, stood in bright flames, those were her words, and that the farmer and her employer, a man called Nathan Kettleson, and also another man called Pieter Jonsson, were still trapped inside the burning building. The Stapakoti family ran with Agnes through the night to try and help extinguish the fire, but by the time they arrived and able to put the flames out, they were too late. The bodies of both men were discovered very badly burnt in their beds. When it grew light the next morning, however, one of those neighbouring farmers took a closer look at the two bodies, and he discovered what he thought resembled stab wounds on the corpses, and on even closer inspection, he discovered what seemed to be remnants of blood on unburnt clothing. He became suspicious and contacted the local authorities. 1 week later, Agnes and another young servant girl from Alugastar there, a girl called Sigga, were brought before the district magistrate and commissioner, a man called Björn Blundell. When they were questioned by Blundell, it was realised that they had both played some part in the death of the men. Basically, what is thought to have happened is that they both gave wildly differing testimonies, and when confronted with the discrepancies in their testimonies, they both admitted that there was another young man involved, a 17-year-old local farmer's son called Fredrik Sigurdsson. Both of them said that he had actually killed the men. Fredrik was arrested by Blundell, and while he denied his involvement and the accusations for a very, very long time, eventually, after speaking with his local family priest, he admitted his guilt. The judicial trial for the defendants was comprehensive and extensive, and it resulted in death sentences for Agnes, Fredrik and Sigga, although Sigga's was later commuted to life imprisonment in Copenhagen. It was thought by Blundell that these three had acted as a gang and conspired to kill both men. Even so, it was Agnes who was unequivocally condemned as the orchestrator of the attack by the community. So it was, as I first heard it, without a doubt, very dark, very tragic, a very grisly tale. Yet there was something that intrigued me about this story, or probably more specifically about Agnes. Without quite knowing why at that time, at 17 years old, I felt what I can only really describe now as an uncanny kinship with this dead convicted murderess. And retrospectively, and I have been thinking about it a lot in basically the last couple of years, I can only speculate that perhaps it was the strange, isolated place of her death that made me think of my own experience at that time, made me think of perhaps my own experience of loneliness. Maybe I saw in her story a tiny fragment of what I was going through. And by saying this, I don't mean by any standards to compare the plight of a woman condemned to die and a homesick 17-year-old kid from Adelaide, but I do think that sometimes in our lives we encounter stories that have particular resonance for us simply because of what we are going through in our own lives at that particular time. And I really do think that this is what happened here. The story was going that way and I collided with it at exactly the right point in my life. Even as my own troubles eased in Iceland and I fell deeply, deeply in love with the country, a compulsion to find out more about Agnes's story continued to grow for me. Who was this woman, I kept asking myself, and how had she come to such a tragic end upon those three hills? And that's the plaque, actually, that they have there on the very site of execution. Had Agnes truly been the monster that she was represented as in records of the murder? Or was she perhaps instead one of those people whose lives are warped by external circumstances? I wanted to know what social or cultural or political forces might have contributed to her fate. Looking back, it is clear to me that I was, in some strange way, haunted by Agnes, and that these feelings I had and this feeling of, particularly of this uncanny kinship that I say, were was heightened by my lack of knowledge and understanding about her life and also these events that contributed to her death upon those three hills. And even when I returned to Australia, thoughts of Agnes continued to both trouble and fascinate me. And each time I returned to Iceland in the years afterwards, and it's probably been about five or six times now, I wondered about Agnes's life story. And it's something that to this day I've never admitted when I've been interviewed, but I say it all the time whenever it's a nice intimate bunch like we are tonight. But I used to also dream about her all the time, and these dreams were so intense and so discomforting that I don't think I could have possibly forgotten about her, even if I'd been inclined to. They unsettled me in such a way that I did feel compelled to discover more about her life. So this quiet preoccupation with a ghost, a figure about whom I knew very, very little, is probably the most private and, in many, many ways, irrational reason why I decided to write about Agnes's life. I recently discovered a journal entry that I wrote basically around the time that I decided I would write this book, and I had written, I need to reach into the dark and grasp the thing that is haunting me. I need to exorcise Agnes's presence from my subconscious. This novel also, and I feel like I should say this, it was never intended to give Agnes a kind of absolution. Another factor that informed my decision to research her life and write her story was my very palpable frustration at the way in which she was commonly represented in sources concerning the murder. Translating documents and sources and articles, I saw that words such as devil and witch and spider were commonly used to describe her, and I could actually discover nothing of her life story outside that immediate context of crime. This very swift and final categorization of women as accused of antisocial behavior, women accused of crime and of infanticide and things like that, into duped angels or evil monsters by their societies was something that I had been researching as part of my PhD. And I realized that Agnes had been subject to this same sort of ideology, this same, I guess, way of regarding women who erred, or erred rather. And I realized I wanted to disrupt this way of thinking. Burial Rites was very much written with the clear intent to represent Agnes as ambiguous and as complex, and to destroy the stereotype of the monstrous woman rubbing her hands together in glee and plotting murder. I was not necessarily interested in her guilt or innocence, and when I started writing this book, even when I was midway through, I had no idea whether she would be one or the other. It didn't actually interest me. What interested me was her humanity. Which brings us to Burial Rites. The novel takes place in 1829, a year after the murders of Nathan Kettelsen and Pieter Jonsson at Lugastadir. Agnes Magnusdottir has already been found guilty of murder, and the 33-year-old servant, now feared and also hated by the small community that she grew up in, has been sentenced to death. At the beginning of the novel, Agnes is taken from Storaborg, which is an isolated farmhouse where she's being detained during the course of her trial, to another isolated farmhouse called Kornsa, where she is to wait until they decide upon the time of her execution. It is here at Kornsa that she meets the farmer's wife, Margaret, and also Toti, the assistant priest responsible for offering her spiritual guidance. Margaret, resentful that she, her husband and their two daughters must live in very close quarters with a convicted murderess, is understandably quite distrustful and hostile towards Agnes. Toti, the priest, very young, very inexperienced, feels responsible for Agnes's salvation, but he also hopes to do right by his boss, the district commissioner, Bjørn Blundell. And this picture here, I might just quickly add, is a modern photograph from across the river of the current Kornsal farm. This is exactly where Agnes was kept. As the summer passes at Kornsal and the light begins to leave the country and the hardships of rural life force the household to work side by side, Agnes's relationship with those around her start to shift and change. And slowly Agnes, through her own private ruminations, which are written in first person, and also her conversations with Margaret and Toti, which are written in third, begins to relate her side of the story, whether or not it is the true version. As the execution date for Agnes draws nearer, those around her again learn that perhaps not everything is as it originally seemed. I thought I might just briefly read a short extract from quite early on in the book. This is one page. This is from when Agnes is about to be moved to Kornsal. And she's basically waiting out her last days at Storaborg, where she's been kept for some time since her trial. This is a section that I hope will give you, if you haven't already read the book, an understanding of how I have tried to capture Agnes's humanity and also create something of a voice for her. After they decide I must leave, the Storaborg men sometimes tie my legs together in the evening, as they do with the forelegs of horses, to ensure I will not run away. It seems that with each passing day, I become more like an animal to them, another dull-eyed beast to feed with what can be scraped together and to be kept out of the weather. They leave me in the dark. They deny me light and air. And when I must be moved, They bind and lead me where they will. They never speak to me here. In winter, in the Badstofa, I could always hear myself breathing, and I'd get scared to swallow for fear the whole room might hear it. The only sounds to keep a body company then were the rustling of Bible pages and whisperings. I'd catch my name on the lips of others, and I knew it wasn't in blessing. And now, when they are forced by law to read out the words of a letter or proclamation, they talk as if addressing someone behind my shoulder. They refuse to meet my eyes. You, Agnes Magnusdottir, have been found guilty of accessory to murder. You, Agnes Magnusdottir, have been found guilty of arson and conspiracy to murder. You, Agnes Magnusdottir, have been sentenced to death. You, Agnes. Agnes. They don't know me. I remain quiet. I am determined to close myself to the world, to tighten my heart and hold on to what has not yet been stolen from me. I cannot let myself slip away. I will hold what I am inside and keep my hands tight around all the things I have seen and heard and felt. The poems composed as I washed and scythed and cooked until my hands were raw. The sagas I know by heart. I am sinking all I have left and going underwater, and if I speak, it will be in bubbles of air. They will not be able to keep my words for themselves. They will see the whore, the madwoman, the murderess, the female dripping blood into the grass and laughing with her mouth choked with dirt. They will say Agnes and see the spider, the witch caught in the webbing of her own fateful weaving. They might see the lamb, circled by ravens, bleating for a lost mother. But they will not see me. I will not be there. Before I finish tonight, I thought I would talk a little bit more about something that is quite close to my heart, and I actually haven't spoken about this at any of my talks or things before. I've mentioned spoken quite a great deal about my curiosity and desire to write about the life of Agnes Magnusdottir as an inspiration, I guess, motivation for this novel. But Burial Rites sort of came about because of another muse that I feel I must mention, and that is Iceland itself. I have said that the first few months of my exchange were very, very challenging. And in many ways, the difficulties I experienced only began to ease when I started to engage with that country's landscape, with its language and with its literature. Each day, I would walk around my small town, climb the mountainside to the cemetery, and look out over the harbour and fjord, or I'd go to the local stream and sit on the snowy bridge. Before travelling to Iceland, I'd never really understood what it was like to have a very deep spiritual connection to a landscape. But there, amongst those mountains, I found both an emotional and a creative sanctuary. Not only is Iceland a ghost-thick landscape, it is a keeper of secrets and stories, and also a haven for those who are born with the love of the written word. Iceland has more books published, more writers and more books read per head than any other place in the world. Isn't that quite extraordinary? There's only 300,000 of them. Ever since the composition of the sagas in the 12th and 13th centuries, Iceland's national identity has been inextricably bound to reading and writing, resulting in almost universal literacy in even the most darkest and impoverished of centuries. And if any of you have read the book and wondered why someone like Agnes, illegitimate and incredibly poor, has such a command of language, it is because of this. Icelanders have been literate for a very, very long time, even as they were boiling their own shoes to sort of keep from starving. Living as an exchange student in a country with such a deep respect for the written word made me realise then that what I had previously regarded as a hobby was actually much more important and much more worth pursuing than I had previously considered. And I actually just want to tell you a very brief story to give you an example of this. One day, as an exchange student, quite early on, because I remember I had no friends, I was sitting in my Icelandic history class, as usual, comprehending absolutely nothing. And I had been given some separate coursework. My teacher had developed a separate syllabus for me to sort of learn the language and learn a bit of the culture. But I found it really, really difficult. Icelandic is a tricky language, and without having a tutor or anyone to sort of guide me through it, I was always at a loss. So I'd basically, this particular day, I'd given up. And instead, I was writing poems in the margin of my workbook. And I'd gotten really involved in what I was writing. And all of a sudden, I heard this cough. And my Icelandic history teacher was looming over me. And this was a gruff man who looked basically like a bear. He was massive, and I was terrified of him because he'd never even once smiled or sort of acknowledged my presence other than shoving me the syllabus. And he demanded to, in Icelandic, I had no idea, then he'd repeat himself in English. He demanded to know what was so much more important than completing the syllabus. And I sort of nervously showed him these poems that I was, you know, incredibly ashamed to have been busted writing. And he took a look at it, put it down, turned away and walked back to his desk and didn't say anything more of it. And I just assumed he'd had enough of, you know, having this Australian kid in his class. The next time I went to his class, I was going to my desk and was about to sit down when he called me over by name. And I went up to his desk as the rest of the students were sitting down. And he wordlessly gave me a book, and I opened it. And in the front, I realised that he'd given actually an English translation of a collection of Icelandic nature poetry. And I could see from the names listed in the index that he was one of the contributing poets. And then I noticed that he had inscribed the book to me, and at the very front, he had written to Hannah, from one poet to another. And from that point onwards, we completely threw the syllabus out the window and I would spend his classes writing poetry. Now, his attitude towards my literary aspirations was not of amused tolerance or not in any way dismissive. Instead, it was of solemn recognition, validation and respect. And to have that, you know, you might have that from your family or from certain teachers in Australia, and I certainly had, but to have that from a stranger, for me, was enkindling. It was, I guess, the push I needed. And very shortly after that day when I received that book, I emailed Flinders University and changed my university degree from whatever it was, some random thing I'd applied for, to the creative writing program that they were offering. Iceland's grip on my heart is unrelenting, and my love of that country and its culture propelled the writing of this book like no other force. Anyone who has visited or lived in Iceland, I think, will understand that one of the reasons why the landscape particularly is so memorable is because of its ineffability. Burial Rites is not only my dark love letter to Iceland as a nation, but it's also my attempt to distill its largely inexpressible beauty into poetry. It is very much my love letter to a place where beauty and horror and tradition and deprivation and literature not only coexist, but are all completely woven together. And I hope if any of you do me the honour of reading the book, that this is perhaps the sense that you are left with. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you so much, Hannah. Are there any questions, please?
Hello. First, I'd like to say the book is amazing, and I can't stop talking about it. And I've got so many people reading it. It's fantastic. Secondly, have you been back since you've written the book, and what has been the reaction over in Iceland?
I have been back. Thank you, first of all, for your very kind words. That's really sweet. That's really generous of you and very sweet. I have been back to Iceland. My second to last trip was my research trip, where I spent 6 intensive weeks basically spending a lot of time in the archives and the libraries and then going up north to visit the sites in the novel. And I did visit my old host family. There was one in particular that I became very close to in their circle of friends. And I stayed with them when I was travelling about the north. And they were sort of, you know, knew why I was there and fairly curious and sort of amused, I think, that I was doing all this research. And then I went most recently for New Year's. I was there just for a couple of days. And by that stage, I had a proof copy of my UK, I think, publication that I had with me at the time, and I gave that to my old host father, who I'm very close to. And he was really excited in the very Icelandic way, which is, oh, that's great for you, and, oh, you know, they hear it's going to snow tomorrow, would you know? You know, they keep you very grounded. But he also reminded me that he's actually severely dyslexic as well, so he's like, I'm not going to read your book, but good for you, you know, we're really happy for you. So, I mean, no, they've been incredibly supportive, and I think they've always been a kind of a bit bewildered at my, you know, huge obsessive interest in Iceland's history. But I guess the response from Icelanders, including many of whom I've never met before, but who I've met through, you know, my recent travels particularly, it's just been one of support and, I guess, interest. And I think, especially knowing that I don't have any Icelandic heritage, I think they're sort of like, oh, good for you for learning about our country. Now let me tell you a story from my town where I'm from. There's a lot of that. So, no, they've been really, really, really wonderful. I'm very, very lucky to have them.
And I was just going to ask what sort of interaction you had with Geraldine Brooks and your mentorship. How did that work?
Yes, I was very lucky to receive that mentorship. That came about through the Writing Australia Unpublished Manuscript Award, which I was actually devastated to hear that they've discontinued after only 2 years. So hopefully, you know, one day they get it going again. Basically, they offered a cash prize as part of that award, but also a certain amount of money to put towards a mentorship. And I remember after, you know, being elated and so on when I won it, and then they came to me a few days later and said, so we better sort out the mentorship. And I said, you know, great, where's the list? You know, who do I get to sort of, you know, maybe ask? And they basically said, look, anyone, you know, they just have to be an Australian writer. And I said, well, what a choice to make. You know, how do you even go about doing that? And I thought, of course, Geraldine Brooks, because I thought not only was it, another Australian historical novelist, but someone who, I guess, had attempted to research in a very similar way that I had. You know, we had a similar methodology. I didn't think for a million years that she'd say yes, but she is very, very generous and down to earth and wonderful, and she did agree. She is based in the US though now, so our mentorship consisted of emails, basically, back and forth. I didn't know whether I would receive the manuscript annotated back from her or whether we would sort of go into any particular detail when we started. What actually ended up happening was, I think, at that stage of the writing process, and I was still rewriting all this time, was that I was bogged down at things very much on the sentence level. And Geraldine was probably the first person to read the manuscript as nothing but a reader. You know, she had no sort of other interests such as my PhD supervisors or even my friends might have had. And she very much considered the novel as a whole. And out of that sort of, I guess, broader regard for the book and for the characters and their stories, we looked at the things that were lacking. And that consisted, the main thing that really evolved out of the conversations that we were having, and they were very general sort of informal conversations, was the ending at that stage was very, very dark. I mean, it's still a dark and tragic book, but it was so grim as to, I think, probably almost be alienating or unbearable. And the best thing that Geraldine Brooks said to me was, you need to let a little more light in. And that was wonderful because at first, you know, on one hand, I knew exactly what she meant by that, but it was non-directive. She let me do, you know, I guess, bring that about in however in basically be guided by my own creative intuition. So as a result of that, a lot of the sort of final scenes that are in the book are fairly new. They were written in later. The other things that sort of came about was basically, I'm sure there's many writers here, and I know that, you know, when you're sitting in front of a computer day in, day out, there are days when you just want 10 o'clock to hurry up so you can go downstairs and have your coffee. And so you think, the reader will never notice if I just have the character conveniently disappear or something like that. You know, you get really lazy. And I had little lazy patches, which I knew were just on my really, you know, annoying or procrastinating days. And she picked up every single lazy patch. She was like, not convincing. What happened here? Sometimes it was just a question mark and then, you know, this particular page number. And I realised that taught me a very valuable lesson as a debut novelist, that, you know, the reader is very smart and even more perceptive than you are. So trust them, but also make sure that you don't try and sort of, you know, deceive them. So, but no, it was a great process, and I'm really indebted to her for her contribution.
Thank you so much for your talk. Most interesting. Before we start the language, could you tell us a little bit about it and your attempts to learn, which must have been a very difficult thing to do?
It was difficult. It's Icelandic, which is basically ancient Norwegian. There was a time when everyone in Scandinavia, in that northern region, was speaking this language in basically modern Icelandic, and then the Swedes went and developed theirs, and the Danes went that way, and the Norwegians went that way, and Iceland has basically stayed the same, which is one of the reasons why modern day, you know, Icelanders today can still read the sagas, which were written in medieval times. It's a, as I said, a Germanic language. It sounds weird and wonderful, and it is incredibly complicated and difficult, and I really, really struggled. I don't think I could have learnt it had I not been immersed in the culture, but also really actively tried to sort of get it under my belt. And the way it kind of occurred, this is a funny little story. Do we have time for more of my little rambling stories? Basically, I was with my first host family. This is still in the, you know, the dark days when I hadn't sort of, you know, found my place in this small community. And I was with my first host family. Didn't speak a lot with my host parents. I was shy, they were shy. But one day my host father, who was this big sort of hulking man who used to wear this sort of floor-length leather jacket, said, "Come on, Hannah, hop in the car, we're going for a drive." And I was like, all right, pitch black outside. It was about maybe 8 o'clock at night. Hop in this car, we're going for a ride, and he drives me through the town right to sort of the very edges where all this sort of industrial buildings are, where the back of the fish factory is and some abandoned warehouses. And I was getting a bit sort of, what are we doing? And then we pulled out inside of this really sort of ramshackle building, and he's like, off you go. So I get out and I'm sort of walking in front of him. He's like, keep going. So I'm walking through this dark sort of alleyway, and then we turn into a very old, this old building, go up this staircase, which I had no idea how we didn't fall through it. It was completely falling apart. And he said, just as we got to the door that was on the second floor, he said, so I'll see you in 2 hours. And I was like, what is going on? I didn't have a clue what was happening. Anyway, he pushed the door open. He said, off you go, have fun, sort of cheerio. And I realised that he was sort of saying goodbye to probably about 10 people who were in this room, which was thick with cigarette smoke and smelt very strongly of black coffee because they were all spilling it out of jam jars. And I was sort of obviously just standing there thinking, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. And then one of them who realised that I was completely kind of discombobulated, sort of came up to me and said, so what would you, in Icelandic, what would you like to do? And I had just was by this day, so sorry, I don't speak Icelandic. He said in English, so if you don't speak Icelandic, then I don't think we can have you on the stage. And I said, well, what stage? What are you doing? And then she said, and I sort of said that to her, and she said, no, we're the theatre group of the town. And your host father called us the other week and said that you like to do drama in your country, and so he said that you would like to come and perform in our plays. And I said, well, I do like drama, but I don't speak Icelandic, so I'm not going to be great on stage for you. She's like, no, you're not. She said, go have a seat. And she got me this cup of coffee and a fag, didn't smoke, just left it there, kind of holding it. And then she said, I've spoken to the others, and we were wondering whether you would like to be our props girl. And I was like, yeah, that sounds good. I'd just be backstage, right? I wouldn't have to get up or be in costume. She'd be like, no, it's completely backstage. And then the play we're doing, you know, there's a lot of people who have to die. Didn't understand the play, she described it to me. But basically, all I gleaned was that there were a whole bunch of sort of special effects that needed to occur. There were guns that needed to be let off and arrows thrown across the stage and paint splattered and all that sort of thing. And I, by this stage, I was just grateful to, you know, be involved in any way. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll be props girl. And they're like, wonderful, you know, welcome to the Leikfélag, welcome to the theatre group. And they gave me a script, and it was only when I returned home that I realised that if I was going to be props girl and throw arrows across the stage and let off, you know, starter guns, I would need to be able to hear and follow an Icelandic script. So I started translating it. And I asked them also to only speak Icelandic to me, only speak English when they really had to, which is probably one of the reasons why the first words that I had in my Icelandic vocabulary were words like blóð, you know, blood, and gunshot, and all this really sort of violent kind of words because of the nature of this play. But eventually, I have no idea how I managed to learn it in time to at least be able to, even if I didn't understand what they were saying, recognise what I was hearing and see it on the page so I could, you know, fake kill them as before they were on stage. So that's actually how I first got my first foothold with Icelandic, and from that point it became much easier. I did actually end up performing with them but when they did Pippi Longstockings, but I was the monkey, so I didn't actually say anything.
One thing I really, really, really loved about it's something to do with the cynical literacy rate of the peasants, and yes, how Agnes was, she really loved to read, and she really was sort of starved for intellectual stimulation. I mean, she was good at chores and whatnot around the farms, but it was sort of like she needed something else. Like, she learned the sagas from her foster mother, and she was always thinking about that kind of thing, and just sort of had this, like, this nameless yearning for something more than was in her life. And I just found that incredible, because it was sort of like, I mean, Aslan was wonderful, sort of like you said, beautiful and sort of like stark and really open and amazing. And in a way, sort of like, I felt like it wasn't only the country which was like just there, it was sort of like, to an extent, just personifying her as well, because she was just the same, like,
absolutely,
she sort of really needed something, which is part of why I think might have driven her to go and live with them.
You're absolutely right. I think it's a really interesting point you make, and it's one that I found really, I guess, necessary and interesting in my own research. You know, a lot of the things that are in the book, as much as this is obviously a work of fiction, I very much took the path that if it was in the historical records and it wasn't biased or, you know, wasn't contradicted elsewhere, I would stick to it. And if it was maybe a little bit contradictory, I could hear, you know, or if I found out certain different accounts of various events, I would use my broader research into 19th century Iceland to suggest the most likely scenario. And it was only in the outright gaps that I would, again, use only that broader research to suggest a particular situation. And when it came to Agnes's literacy and her love of the written word, I thought very early on that this would be the case, because that would be one way of explaining why she is so lyrical when she sort of has these first-person passages. But I was very fortunate to discover that that is actually how she was. I found several first, like, primary sources, for instance, accounts of her confirmation when she was 13 years old. And there is, you know, a brief summary of the day, which children were, you know, confirmed, what happened, what did they read. And then there's a note by the priest afterwards where it basically says that out of all these six children, Agnes Magnusdottir was the only one who was able to read this to this level. And then there were poems that were found that were written by her. And then I found other accounts that supported this by saying that she'd gotten quite a name for herself for being a poet. And then I found another book which talked about her huge love of reading as a child and how she would often sort of slack off when she was supposed to be minding the sheep and steal books, basically, to read. And you sort of start to take all these little suggestions and you soon, I guess, get a very complete picture of someone who, in many ways, as you say, is deprived of books, as many Icelanders were, but had this yearning and had this literacy. And I think also had the ability to reflect and, I guess, the broader world and how she fitted into it and maybe rebel against that because of the gift of literature, which is, you know, a gift of perception, I think.
Hannah, your book is just lovely. I just loved it so much I bought a copy with my friends.
Oh, thank you.
Did you have much difficulty in resisting the temptation to emphasise any misogynistic aspect of the story?
Yes, I mean, a big concern of mine, as I think I've said, was to resist the categorical stereotyping of Agnes. And I wanted to make sure that in my attempts to make sure that she was allowed ambiguity, not to stereotype the male characters as sort of all misogynists or all complicated, as all misogynists or all, you know, sort of stereotypes themselves as villains, I suppose, which could have been very easy to do. And that was a struggle, particularly because these male characters are largely seen through Agnes's eyes, and she has fair reason to hate them and to despise them and to consider them in very black and white sort of shades. So this was something that I sort of had to negotiate. The misogyny that is in the book, I think, is more representative of that particular historical period, you know, rather than of Iceland. And it's funny, in many ways people have been surprised by the amount that is in there, because Iceland today is one of the most, you know, I guess, liberal-minded, most equal nations that we have. It's a fantastic place to live, and you see that when you live there. It's, you know, women are very fairly represented in politics particularly, which I think is something that is very noticeably and sadly lacking here in Australia. So this was something that I again had to negotiate, trying to take my understanding of contemporary Iceland and the role of women there, and the pretty well lack complete absence of misogyny in contemporary Iceland, to that historical period, and the way in which women were often subordinated, not so much of their gender originally, but if they were female and also incredibly poor. I think actually class has a lot more to do with it than maybe some people might originally recognise or, you know, first recognise. If you, as a woman who was married or a farmer's wife, you were able to own property. If your husband died, you basically could run the farm. You didn't have to remarry, you owned it. You could acquire property if you were a married woman. If you were a landless servant, basically, if you were anyone who did not possess land, you were put at a huge disadvantage. And you throw in the case of your gender, if you're female, you're completely at the mercy of your employer, who can decide whether or not they're going to toss you out into the snow. It was illegal to change residence, except at this very particular time in May. So if you were going to be kicked out, people were actually disobeying the law if they agreed to hire you. So you were in quite a compromised and vulnerable position. And I think some people obviously would have abused that, but it's not something that I think is particularly characteristic of Icelanders. I think, again, it was that, you know, the 19th century, basically.
I think this might have to be the last.
Sorry. You are an outstanding person. Can you give us some idea of what molded you, like your family, where you grew up, your school, and then the ridiculous to end up, have you been on American TV shows?
I'm one of those incredibly fortunate souls to have an incredibly beautiful and supportive family. In fact, my father and sister are sitting down the front, and I'm getting emotional just even looking at them, so I'm going to avoid them. They have always, my parents particularly, have always read to me, have always supported my love of writing, and never ever discounted it as a hobby. I think there is a difference between telling your children that they should always regard their artistic sort of talents or artistic interests as a hobby, and that they should go out and get a real job. There's a difference between that and telling your children that what they are doing is worthwhile, and yes, it should be the primary focus of their life if it's what makes them happy, but that in order to make that the focus and sustain that focus, they might need to, you know, go, I don't know, be a doctor or do something else, you know. They might need to go and have another career or stack shelves or something like that. And my parents were always, I guess, regarded my interests in an incredibly supportive light, but in a practical one too, which made me realise, you know, didn't fill me with false hope, gave me, I guess, enough tenacity to keep on doing what it was I wanted to doing, but to also, you know, go investigate other areas of the world. So I think if there's anything that has shaped me, it has been my family and their support. And, you know, I think also in many ways, growing up in the Adelaide Hills, it's such a fantastic community and it will always be my home. And I think there are so many interesting people who live there. It's not a parochial place by any means, and I really appreciate that, because even though I was growing up within, I guess, a very small community of my own, my view of the world was not small, and I'm grateful for that. And also to even have opportunities, for instance, to go to Iceland. That would never have happened had my, you know, local high school counsellor said, hey, would you have a look at this pamphlet? So really, I think, you know, where you come from has a lot to do with where you end up, and that's certainly the case in my life.
Please stand for me.